Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. It's a beautiful day here in Iowa. Not warm, but sunshiny.
It's a beautiful day in Texas, too, which is where I am. And we'll find out shortly where our guest is calling from today. Mom, you want to introduce her?
Yes, I do. Our guest today is Jillian Cantor, and she has a BA in English from Penn State University and an MFA from the University of Arizona. She is the author of award-winning novels for teens and adults, including, most recently, the critically acclaimed The Lost Letter, The Hours Count, and Margot. Born and raised in a suburb of Philadelphia, she currently lives in Arizona with her husband and two sons. And this book is the title of this book is In Another Time, and it is a page-turner, believe me.
And welcome to Writer's Voices, Jillian.
Thank you for having me.
And are you calling from Arizona, or are you on tour?
I am, yeah. I'm in Arizona right now. I'm in Tucson. Great. And it's a little chilly here for us. I mean, it's in the 60s, but yeah, it feels chilly to me.
Yeah. I understand. Down, I'm in Austin right now, and it feels chilly here. I think it's right around 60. Even though, you know, a few weeks ago I was in single-digit temperatures up in Iowa. But it doesn't take long to adapt to warmer temperatures.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Jillian, how many books have you published so far?
So In Another Time is my eighth novel that I've published.
Wow. And how did you get started?
So I majored in English in college. I thought that I was going to go into journalism at first, and I was on the newspaper in my college, and then I did an internship at a local newspaper near Philadelphia where I grew up the summer after my freshman year, and I really didn't enjoy it. I kept getting really bored by having to tell the truth in all of these stories, and I thought, kind of writing that I like. I want to write creatively. So when I went back to college that fall, and I did keep all of my stories factually accurate, just so you know.
It was hard, but you did it anyway.
I went back to college that fall. I took my first fiction writing class. And so that was sort of my real start into writing. I ended up, you know, I graduated with a major in English. I had an emphasis in creative writing. And then I went on to get my MFA after that. So that was the very beginning. My first novel was published in 2009. So it's been just about 10 years. It was like February, wow. 2009. And that was a young adult novel. And so I've written a few young adult novels. I've written, a few adult historical novels have been my most recent.
Which is the case within Another Time.
In Another Time, exactly.
Yes, an adult. Now, is there really that much difference in these days between young adult and adult, other than the age of the main character?
Yeah. So my first novel, it was called The September Sisters. I actually was writing an adult novel. I thought it was an adult novel, but the narrator was a 13-year-old girl, and my agent was not able to sell it as an adult novel. She tried to sell it for about a year and a half, and we kept getting these really lovely rejections where people just loved the book, but they had just published another book with a child narrator and didn't fit with their list or whatever it was. And so my agent said, let me try a few young adult editors. And she did, and then we ended up selling the book in an auction. But then at that point, they came to me and said, well, this feels very adult. You have to make it young adult. So, which I did. I had to revise it and just work on the voice a little bit. But I, you know, as a writer, because since then I've written two more young adult books, and I've written five adult books. I'm working on my sixth. As a writer, I don't feel like there's much difference. I mean, to me, it's just sort of about the age of the character you're writing and, you know, with that, what's going on in that character's life. But as a writer, I approach the stories very much the same. Mm-hmm. It's more like a marketing distinction, I think. And I don't know. I mean, as an adult, I read young adult novels, and I read adult novels, and I have a preteen and a teen, and they read young adult novels, and they read adult novels, too. So,
well, yeah, you know, just this kind of distinction not being a real distinction, I think, can go back many, many years, because didn't we all as teens read Jane Eyre?
Mm-hmm. Right. You know? And yeah, it was, I mean, it was different. I don't really remember there being a young adult distinction when I was a teen. I don't think it was quite the thing that it is today.
And it does seem like young adult novels are some of the very, very best selling. And, you know, it's not just young adults that are reading them.
Yeah, no, I'm reading them too.
Yeah. I have read quite a few of them myself. They do tend to, maybe their plots are a little less complex sometimes. Do you find that to be true?
You know, I feel like it just depends on the book. And, you know, I think for a while the dystopian genre got really big in young adult, and then that seems to be trailing off a little bit. But I think it depends on the book. I mean, for me, I'm just thinking about the character that I'm writing and then what this character's thoughts and fears and emotions and problems are. And of course, that's going to be different for a 16-year-old than for a 40-year-old.
Right, right.
But as a writer, it feels very much the same to me.
I'm interested in the historical novels. How many of those have you done?
So In Another Time is the fourth one that I've published.
And are they all World War II setting?
No. I mean, In Another Time is, and The Lost Letter. Margo is post-World War II in the late 50s, but it does sort of go back to the war a little bit. And then my novel, The Hours Count, is about Ethel Rosenberg. And so that's more in the 50s. It's about the Red Scare. Mm-hmm. I mean, the same, you know, general time period, but that one's not about World War II.
So tell me this. How do you go about finding all the details of the era that you're writing about? I mean, it's, you know, it's got to take a lot of work to do that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much on the internet, which is amazing. And just usually I'm reading books, I'm going to websites, I'm talking to people. I mean, it depends, you know, it depends what I'm trying to find, but there's so much that you can find. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C., they have an amazing website. I mean, I've been there in person also, but also their website is amazing. They have pretty much anything you would want to find about that era. But yeah, I mean, it just depends what I'm writing about.
It's amazing how the internet has changed the possibility of finding things, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
I wonder, you know, we have done quite a few interviews recently this spring and also in prior years on historical novels set in the World War II time period, some Holocaust, mm-hmm. some more on the, you know, soldier side. And it is one of my favorite eras of historical fiction to read. But I'm wondering if the reason there's so many coming out now is because the people who lived through that and that you can still talk to about it aren't going to be around much longer.
Right.
And yeah, so we got to capture those stories now.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a part of it. For me, what I love is that it is a recent enough history where you can still talk to people, mm-hmm. but also far enough away where I feel like people my age and younger and even a little bit older than me don't know enough about it, and they should. So that's sort of what draws me into it.
I think you're right about that. I think that's true. So In Another Time is set in Germany, primarily, and partially in England and France a little bit.
Yes.
Right? And did you visit all those locations?
I didn't. I mean, I have been to France before, but I didn't go to research for this book. But no, I didn't. And, you know, I did all of my research online. The town that they live in Germany is a fictional town, but it's supposed to be a suburb of Berlin. So I was able to have some leeway to create there because I made it a fictional town, which I like to do. But no, I didn't go.
That's smart.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you use Google Earth, you know, to...
I did use Google Earth, but I mean, it's also hard because... you know, what it is now is not what it was in 1931 because the war destroyed so many things. But I did use Google Earth, and I also read a lot of books about Berlin at the time and, you know, researched what Berlin was like at the time. And so that helped too.
And the concept for the story, for the plot, Was this something that was prompted by some true story that you read about? I mean, obviously, without giving too much away, there's elements of it that you that probably would not have come from a true story.
Yeah.
But there are elements that could have. Or was it totally imaginary?
No, a few real things prompted me. One thing, I had gone to speak to a Holocaust survivors group about my last novel, The Lost Letter, and the people there were telling me their stories, which was amazing. And one woman was talking to me about how she was a very young girl in Germany as Hitler was coming into power. She was Jewish. Her family was Jewish. And her parents just refused to leave Germany because they said, we're German too. This is our country. Why should we have to leave? And so I've always been sort of interested in why people left Germany or didn't leave Germany at that time. And I had never really thought about the fact that there must have been so many people living there who just didn't embrace anything, you know, Hitler thought, and really believed, well, this is our country too. Like, we're not going to abandon it. So that really resonated with me. That little true nugget sort of started the story. And then I had read an article a few years ago about a man who played the violin in Auschwitz and it ended up saving his life. And then after the war, he became a concert violinist. And so that had sort of stuck with me. You know, Hannah is the violinist in the story. She's completely fictional, but he was just the briefest flash of inspiration for her.
Now, Hannah did play the violin and was caught up in the Holocaust. Were there orchestras at any of the concentration camps? Were there ways that a person could have been allowed to live because of that talent or that ability?
Yeah, that's all true.
Yeah,
and I don't want to give away anything about the book. I'm
right.
Say a spoiler, but yes, there were women's orchestras and men's orchestras in some of the concentration camps, and you know, those prisoners were treated better because of it, because they were performing and then, you know, experienced a different kind of trauma, a survivor's guilt afterwards. Mm. So that's true.
Wow. Now, she had a Stradivarius, right?
Yes, she did.
And that was amazing. I'm surprised that in the book that the Germans didn't take it away from her.
Yeah, and I think I included in my author's note that I gave myself a little bit of fictional leeway to allow her to have Stradivarius, have it survive, you know, the whole World War II with her. But yeah, she does.
I wonder how many of those survived today. Do you have any idea in your research? Did you run across
you know, I
that?
Did at one point when I was researching, like off the top of my head, I don't remember, but some of them did survive the war. And I was reading something recently or watching something recently people were sharing on Facebook, and it was a video of people playing the violins, the Stradivarius violins that the Nazis had confiscated. Wow. And they were just like doing something with them recently. It was really fascinating.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I'll bet.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jillian Cantor, author of In Another Time. Jillian, it's when you gave us sort of your history about how you got into writing. You went to college, you studied creative writing, you got a master's in it, and then you started writing and publishing. Was it really that easy?
Oh, no, it was not easy at all. I didn't tell you about the hard part. So I got my MFA in 2002, I graduated, and I had written a book that was my graduate thesis for grad school. It was a complete novel, and I tried to get an agent for it probably for about 2 years or so, 2 or 3 years, and I could never get an agent for the book. And a lot of agents were very complimentary about my writing, but they just felt like the book wouldn't sell, and or, you know, for whatever reason, didn't want to take it on. So I finally wrote another book, and that was probably like early 2004 or so. I tried to get an agent for that book for months, still could not get an agent. And then I had a baby. So I put it in a drawer for a little while. And it wasn't until my son was about 18 months old and he was really starting to talk. And I thought, one day he's going to ask me what I do. And I don't want to have to tell him that I'm a failed writer. And I gave up. So the book out again. I revised it again. And I sent out more agent queries, and then I finally did get an agent at that point. But that was, let's see, my son was 2. So that was like a good 6 years after I got my MFA, and I had been trying pretty much that whole time to get an agent. And then even after she took the book on, it took like another year or two for her to sell it. So it definitely was not easy at all. But I'm still with the same agent. It's been almost 13 years that we've been together. So I do feel like once I connected with an agent, it was definitely the right agent. But it was a little bit of a struggle.
Was that the September Sisters?
Yes, that ended up being the September Sisters.
And that was the one that you thought you were writing an adult novel, but
ended up being
a young adult?
Wow. Yep. Yeah.
Do you think that getting the master's was important in your development as a writer?
No, not really. I mean, it was, I don't know. If I had to do it again, I don't know if I would do it or not. I mean, it was, I guess I did learn, and it kind of gave me the space to write this failed novel that I never sold, and maybe I was going to need to do that either way. But I don't think it ultimately helped me. It didn't help me get published for sure. You know, I didn't get any publishing connections, and I didn't ultimately publish anything that I wrote while I was there. So I don't know. I mean, the good thing was that I had a really good fellowship, so I didn't pay for it. So it was sort of like 2 years for me to write and learn, and I guess that was a good thing. But I don't know if I would do it again if I had the chance.
I mean, it's a lot of time. But would you have had the discipline to complete a novel on your own outside of that? Maybe you would, maybe some people would,
yeah.
But some people it might, the structure of the program might be a big help in that too.
Yeah. I mean, I have written a lot of novels since then, so I feel like I would have, but maybe I wouldn't have had the confidence to do it. I don't know. Yeah. That's a good point.
Growing up, were you a avid reader?
Yeah, I was an avid reader, always reading growing up. My mom used to take my sister and I to the library in the summer, and they would have, I think there was like a limit, you could check 10 books out of the library at a time. And so we would go, and I would get my 10 books, and then it would be like 2 days later, and I'd be begging my mom to take me back to the library.
Oh my God.
I was always reading as a kid.
When I ran out of library books as a kid, I would, my mom, had a subscription to Reader's Digest condensed books.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, we had that too.
Yep. And these were adult books, but they were scrubbed of all the sex
bad
and
stuff.
Violence, basically.
Mm-hmm. All the interesting parts.
Yeah, really. So they didn't mind me reading them, even at a pretty young age. And so I would, when I ran out of reading material, I'd head for that shelf I read a lot of pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was always reading as a kid. And I think like my mom also, she never put my sister and I in camp in the summer. She would always just be like, go read a book. And so I think that was how I spent most of my summers in elementary school. I was just reading.
Right.
And I did have friends and they would come over and stuff too. But it was, you know, my mom was a big believer in like, go figure out how to entertain yourself and I'll take you to the library when need be.
Learning to read and loving to read is really a pretty great thing for a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel sorry for kids who don't ever develop that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I still love to read. I don't, unfortunately, read as much as I did as a kid just because I don't have the time or the space to do it. And it's very hard for me to read when I'm writing a book. But I still love it. Over Christmas break, I took 2 weeks off, my kids were off, and I think I read 10 books. That was all. It's so great. Yeah.
So why is it hard to read while you're writing?
I just feel like when I'm writing, I have the voices of my characters in my head, and so it's hard for me to get absorbed into somebody else's story. I can read something really different while I'm writing, so I generally don't read any historical fiction when I'm writing my own historical fiction, but I could read a YA novel or sometimes I'll read a thriller or a romance novel, you know, if I take a weekend off. But it's just very hard for me to get caught up in a story that's not my own if I'm caught up in my own story. And I'm also reading a lot of nonfiction as I'm writing for research too.
Of course, of course. Why did you go towards historical fiction when, you know, you've been successful as a young adult? What caused you or what led you to switch into the adult historical fiction?
Well, I mean, adult fiction was really always where I kind of saw myself. You know, I thought that's what I was writing all along. And so I always knew I wanted to get back to that. But the historical part I sort of fell into by accident. I came up with the idea for the story. My first novel, historical novel, is called Margot. And it was the story of Anne Frank's older sister, Margot Frank, and what would have happened if she had survived the war and had seen the success of her sister's diary and like what path her life would have taken. So I had the idea for the book first. And then I knew it would have to be historical in order to write it. You know, I didn't want to write about her in 2008 or whenever I was writing it. I wanted to write about her in 1959, which was the year the Hollywood movie came out based on Anne Frank's diary. So it was the idea for the story first, and then I knew it had to be historical, which was terrifying to me because I'm not a historian. I never really even liked history in school. But once I wrote that book, I realized I love historical fiction because it's fascinating to me to think about women who are just like me, who are mothers and sisters and daughters, but who are living in a different time, and to imagine what their lives are like, and also how, you know, ordinary women's lives can change when they're faced with these extraordinary circumstances, which of course you find in the World War II era a lot. So I guess I fell into it by accident, but then I really loved it.
Wow. So Jillian, let's talk a little bit about In Another Time and sort of can you give a overview of the plot and the characters?
Sure. So In Another Time is a love story between Max, who is a Christian bookshop owner, and Hannah, who is a Jewish violin player, and they meet and they fall in love just outside of Berlin in 1931. And Max narrates the story from 1931 to 1936 as they're falling in love and Hitler's rising to power. And then Hannah's story begins in 1946. She wakes up in a field with just her violin, and she has no memory of the past 10 years, doesn't know where she was during the war or what happened to Max. And then her story moves forward in time as she tries to rebuild her life and her violin career, and it alternates chapters between her going forward between 1946 and 1958, and then Max telling their story between 1931 and 1936.
And this format of one chapter for Max and the next one for Hannah, have you used that format before?
Not exactly that. My last novel, The Lost Letter, had two stories, and one was set in the late 1930s in Austria, and one was set in 1989 in LA, and it was two different characters and going, you know, back and forth, but they were separate. So this is the first time where I've done a love story and both points of view, and you kind of got to, you know, see things differently from both of their points of view, which was fun.
Well, it for me, it made it easy to follow the plot as they move along the timeline. So I liked that. I really did.
Oh, good. Yeah. It got a little tricky to write at a certain point.
I actually
make a big chart because I wrote it in the order that it appears in the book, that I drafted it that way initially. And I made a chart on my wall in my office at a certain point, and it had, because it spans about 30 years almost. So I had each year and what each character was doing and how old they were, because I was writing like the 1948 chapter before I had written the 1935 chapter, but then Hannah was thinking about something that happened in 1935. So I had to know it. So it did get a little complicated to map it all out.
Yeah.
So you wrote alternating chapters, alternating points of view in that chronological order.
Yes.
I could see where that would be complicated.
I wrote it in the chronological order, but then when I revised it, I revised Max's story all at once and Hannah's story all at once just to make sure there was continuity and pacing and flow. So I looked at it both ways, but the initial draft is as you see it now.
And would you consider doing it the other way?
If
you were to have this, you know, something with this structure again.
Against it. I guess it just didn't makes sense to me. I like to write, I guess I like to write in the order that a reader reads it, because otherwise I have trouble sort of keeping track of the pacing and the flow of the story.
Right.
And so when I'm writing in the order it appears, I get a sense if it gets boring or if it slows down. And I have trouble doing it the other way. So it's not that I'm against it. I just couldn't wrap my head around it, I guess.
Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. Jillian, how about reading a little bit from Max and from Hannah's point of view?
These are the first two chapters of the book after the prologue. And so this is how Max begins. And this is Max in 1931. Max heard Hannah before he saw her. Rather, he heard her violin as it pierced through the empty auditorium at the Lyceum, sharp and bright, passionate and enormous. He'd never heard a violin before, other than maybe once on a record playing on his mother's phonograph when he was a boy. And the sound in real life, echoing in the large empty room, was so beautiful and intense that, for a moment, Max froze. Max had opened the door to this particular auditorium quite by accident. He'd been looking for Herr Detweiler's lecture on economics, which, as it turned out, was taking place in a different auditorium and the building across the green. The Lyceum in Gutenstadt was large, sprawling. Max had read the schedule wrong and had reversed his course, landed himself exactly opposite where he'd intended, here, instead, where Hannah was practicing on stage. He walked toward her, toward the music. Her eyes were closed and she was small, but her body swung with the notes she played, a force like a giant gust of wind that bowed her back and forth and yet would never topple her. No, she was in control of the music, of the instrument. That much was clear to him. Even knowing nothing about music, about the violin, this woman possessed the music, not the other way around. She finished with one hard downward sweep of the bow, and then she opened her eyes, saw him standing there, not 10 feet from the stage now, because he'd walked closer and closer as he'd been listening. She put her hand to her mouth. Shocked, alarmed, angry. I'm sorry, he stammered. I've gotten the wrong auditorium. He suddenly felt foolish for having invaded her space. It wasn't a performance. Her music this morning had been meant to be private, and feeling like an intruder, he turned and ran out. It wasn't until he was across the green, walking into the correct building, that he realized he should have introduced himself, that he should have asked her name, because the sound of that violin, her violin, he could not get it out of his mind. So that's their very first interaction. And then his chapter continues on a little bit from there. But I'm going to read a little bit from Hannah's first chapter, which is the next chapter in the book.
Great.
This is Hannah in 1946. When I opened my eyes, I was in a field. The sky was black. A million stars glittered above me, and my first thought was how beautiful they were, how the night was diamonds in Beethoven's concerto in D major. And then I realized I was holding my violin. I clutched in my right hand, my fingers numb and cold and shaking. My hands vibrated so much that the violin was hitting my leg, the hard wood bruising my kneecap. Max, I called out. Max? My voice quivered and the words echoed back at me. No response, only silence in night sky and stars and... My violin? I was just in the bookshop. I was playing Mahler, and Max was sitting behind the counter reading a book. Play me the fire, Hannah. And he looked at me the same way he did when we were lying next to each other in bed, his green eyes ablaze like music and desire were the same thing. Fire. I'd smiled at him, closed my eyes to play, and the music had taken over me. But then there was that horrible sound, pounding against the glass, men's voices, the SA. They were shouting to open up, shouting that we had broken the law. What had we done? The store was closed for the night. Max had the front door locked, but I liked the acoustics in the shop, so I often practiced there at night. The men rattled the door, pushing on it. The lock wouldn't hold much longer. You have to hide, Max said, running toward the back of the store. More banging against the glass storefront, and I ran to where Max was standing. He grabbed me, pulled me close, and hugged me so hard. And that was the last thing I remembered before now. The starry night, this field... How in the world had I gotten here? And where was here exactly? Max, I cried out again, softer this time. Because the SA, what if they were still looking for me? But the field was open, quiet, the night air crisp and cool. I shivered. I heard an owl hooting somewhere in the distance, but that was all. I pinched myself on the arm and it hurt, but nothing changed. I wasn't dreaming. I was here wherever this was, and I was all alone. I began walking because what else could I do? I couldn't stay in this field waiting for Max or for those horrible SA who wanted to, what, arrest me, murder me? And what was my crime exactly? I shivered again, but I clutched my violin and kept walking. I walked and I walked and I walked, and the sky began to turn from black to pearly gray to orange blue. In the distance, there was a cathedral. I saw the steeple first rising above the hill, and as I got closer to the structure, it looked vaguely familiar, like the cathedral I could see from the train window riding from the Hauptstrasse towards the Lyceum. But that church was white. This one was brown. My legs were so tired, but I could just make it there, and surely someone inside could help me get back to the bookshop. And Max would know what happened. Max would remember. Max, what if something had happened to him? I went over it again and again in my mind, retracing those last words, those last moments with Max, pushing myself to remember after that. But try as I might, I still had no memory of getting to this field. By the time I reached the church door, I was so thirsty and cold and tired. My head ached and something was terribly wrong. I knew it was. I just wasn't sure what. And my body was heavy with dread and exhaustion. Had the SA broken down the door, then taken me, brought me here? Had I hit my head? Is that why I could not remember? Was I injured? I put my hand to my head, my face, but everything felt normal. No bumps, no blood, no pain. I opened the door to the church and walked inside. It was filled with wooden pews, all empty. A large stained glass window in front was partially boarded up as if it had shattered and not yet been repaired. Hello, I called out. Is anyone here? Hello? No one answered back and I was exhausted. It was much warmer inside the church and I went to the closest pew, lay down on the hardwood bench and hugged my violin to my chest. I would rest just for a little while and maybe when I awoke I would be back in the bookshop, back with Max. And the chapter goes on from there, but I think I'm going to stop.
Okay. So Hannah's writing, you're writing Hannah's story in first person, and I can't remember now, was Max's in first or was it in third?
Max's in third person.
Okay. So that's an interesting choice. Tell us about that and what you're accomplishing by doing that.
I wanted them to... I wanted their chapters to have a different feel. I felt like switching up, you know, first person versus third person definitely gave them a different feel. But also I wanted Max's chapter to have a little bit more distance. I wanted the reader to feel a little bit closer to Hannah. I feel like ultimately this is Hannah's story. It's a love story between Max and Hannah, but then more, it's almost a love story between Hannah and her violin. And so I felt like the third person gave Max's story just a little bit more distance than Hannah's in the first person.
Yeah, I agree. Mom, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too. That was good. That was very good. Yeah.
Do you have some questions, Mom?
I just found it extremely interesting that she had so many details about that time. And I see now how she could do that because of the internet. Because it was a horrendous time, and it was one that the whole country was in turmoil and everything. So it was, you know, it was really something. And then that she was able to move on, though, and didn't she eventually end up in America?
She did, yeah. The book starts and ends with her in New York City.
Yeah, yeah. That was good. And but the fact that, well, I'm not going to be a spoiler until what happens. But
it's kind of hard to talk about this book without giving anything away.
Yeah, it is. But it is a page turner. I'll tell you that much.
All right, good. Yeah, I know. And I'm trying really hard not to spoil. But I think if you go on Goodreads and read the reviews, there's spoilers already. But I don't want to be the one spoiling it. So
right,
I'm trying.
Right. Well, so let's just say there's a little bit of a twist in the story so that it makes it kind of not your run-of-the-mill World War II love story. And I'm just curious, without giving it away, like how and why that idea came about to do that.
So I think we can say there's a little bit of time travel in the book because it is in the description.
Okay.
So I don't feel like that's giving anything away. So there's a little element of time travel. It's definitely not a science fiction story, but there is that little element there. And for me, that came from, you know, my initial idea of would you leave Germany or wouldn't you leave Germany and why or why not? And my sort of initial spark from the story was, what if you had this even magical way to get out of Germany. Would you still stay? And so that was where that came from.
Okay, that's very interesting. And time travel, historical love stories, you know, with the Outlander series are,
yeah,
you know, something that people are kind of will accept. You know, they'll suspend disbelief for the sake of the story.
Yeah, and I mean, it definitely, I don't feel like it's a huge part of the story. It's definitely there, and it definitely impacts what happens.
Right,
but,
right.
Not like Outlander, where it's, you know, that's the basic.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Was it at all harder for you to write from a male point of view than the female?
So I actually did my last book was half from a male point of view too. It was about a stamp engraver's apprentice named Christoph, and he narrated most of the chapters during the Austrian resistance. So I had already done it once before. So this time it didn't feel strange or hard to me. I think maybe I had more confidence because I had done it before. But I think that's also why I put him in third person. And I did that in my last book too. And just going back to that, we were already talking about it. But I think that's part of why I put him in third person, because I had a little bit of distance from him too as I was writing. And I don't know. I don't know if I would have been as comfortable writing him in first person.
To be honest, I'm always a little suspect of male authors who write female first person.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, and I guess I thought the same thing. You know, I felt like I really love Max as a character, and I felt like I was able to tell his story, but it was in third person, so I did feel like I took a little bit of a step back from him, whereas Hannah was in first person.
Right, right. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jillian Cantor, author of In Another Time.
Tell us about this book that you're working on now.
So I can't say that much about it, but I am working on a new book, and it is a historical novel, and it'll be out in either 2020 or 2021, depending when I get it done, hopefully 2020. And it's another historical novel. It's about a strong woman, and it's really examining the choices that we make as women and how they impact our lives. But I'm not going to say any more about it right now, but I should be able to share details soon, hopefully. I have about 100 pages of it, so I need to finish writing it right now.
Okay, I now remember what I was going to say. So you talked about the story being a love story between Hannah and Max, but also between Hannah and her violin. And her career as a violinist is extremely important to her. And both before the war and after, she runs up against an obstacle to this career in the fact that she was a woman.
Yes. And Jewish before the war.
Okay. And Jewish. Yeah. Before the war. So how did you do a lot of research on like when were women given the ability to play in major orchestras, and was it really, you know, how much of an obstacle was it in that time period, and when did that obstacle or has
it disappeared? I mean, it definitely was an obstacle in that time period, and so I did read that most of the orchestras in Europe shut down during the war because all of the players were men and they all went to fight in the war. And then even afterwards, it took a long time for them to start up because many of them were injured. And so even at that time, it would have been very, very hard for a woman to be in an orchestra. And I sort of fictionalized the orchestra that Hannah's in. And I mean, when you read the book, you can sort of see how I invented this position for her. And I was even talking to my son's music teacher about the book, and he said, well, it would be impossible for a woman to be in an orchestra at this time. And I said, I know. So I had to sort of fictionalize a little bit. You know, I'm not exactly sure when that changed because I was just researching that particular time that Hannah was in, but obviously it has changed, which is a good thing. But, you know, I think like so many other fields at the time, I mean, they were seen as men's fields.
Right.
And there was so much discrimination against women just for being women.
And you know, when I grew was growing up, I was a child in the 60s and 70s, and when I went to learn to play an instrument, there were some instruments that were considered girl instruments and other ones that were considered male instruments. And one of the ones that it was a male instrument was the trombone. And just a couple weeks ago down here, I attended a symphony orchestra with a soloist who was the trombonist, the principal trombonist of the New York Philharmonic. And I actually met him on the plane coming down here. And we have a mutual friend who was like the dean of students where his daughter went to school, and it was my dad's college roommate's son, so all this connection. So I went to see the concert, and they had a youth, I think it was a middle school trombone, just trombone orchestra that played before the concert. And I was amazed to see how many girls were in it. Because when I was in junior high, high school, it would have been almost unheard of to have a female trombonist.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that was probably true even when I was in school in the 80s and 90s. And there were sort of gendered instruments. I remember I was in jazz band in middle school, and I think I was the only girl in jazz band for a year.
And what did you play?
I played the saxophone,
Okay.
but everyone, I don't know, we had a, it was a small jazz band. And then the following year there was a girl who played the trumpet, I think. So there were two of us. But it's kind of interesting. I don't know if it's different now or not. I'm not sure.
I think it is. I think it is.
I hope so.
I
Should
hope so too. I
be.
hope so too.
It's true too that there aren't too many boys or men that play flute. I don't think,
Because flute was women, was pushed as a girl's instrument. I remember there was like one or two boy clarinetists. Most of the rest of them were girls. Now, the trumpet was, I had two good friends that played trumpet that were girls, and they were two of the best trumpet players in the band, but most of the rest were boys. Did
Yeah,
you
I mean
ever?
it's still sort of gendered, but I think when Hannah was trying to get into an orchestra in Europe, it would have been nearly impossible for a woman to be in a professional, what they would have considered a men's orchestra.
Did you ever play violin, Jillian?
I did not, no. I played the clarinet and the saxophone in high school, and I played the clarinet even in college. And I haven't played the clarinet in probably 20 years, but I still, I mean, my family, we're always going to the symphony, we're going to music. Music's definitely a big part of our lives. And both of my sons played the violin for a year or two when they were younger. So I sat through a bunch of their violin lessons. That was the closest I ever came to playing the violin.
Well, you had to have some understanding of the violin as an instrument in order to write this.
I really didn't when I started, and I did. I asked. I mean, I read a lot. I read, actually read this really interesting memoir called Gone by Min Kim. It just came out in the last few years, and she's a professional violinist, and she was a violin prodigy. And the book is about how her violin gets stolen and how it impacts sort of every part of her life and paralyzes her. And it was just really fascinating to read about how her instrument was such a big part of her life. And I feel like that definitely inspired me for Hannah. So I read a lot. I listened to a lot of violin music every morning before I played, and I specifically tried to pick out the pieces Hannah plays in the book by listening to them. I watch a lot of violin tutorials on YouTube, and even just some of the details and some of the terminology, I asked my son, who he played the violin for about 3 years, maybe 3 or 4 years. And I just asked him, if it sounded accurate, and I was able to sort of use him a little bit as a resource.
Wow. Well, why did you have her be a violinist rather than a clarinetist, which you would have had more familiarity with?
Well, I mean, I felt like in Europe at the time, and I mean, again, I don't really want to spoil the book, but when you learn, what she was doing with her violin, I feel like that was historically accurate to make her a violinist. She could have been a cellist or a violist, but I felt like it would have had to have been a stringed instrument.
Okay. And and the violin is maybe the easiest one to hang on to.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would have been practically very hard for her to lug her cello around,
Yeah,
right?
yep. So, Jillian, let's talk a little bit about your actual writing routine. Do you get up and write every day, a certain time, or as a mother, do you have to have more flexibility? Are you, yeah.
Yeah, I usually write every weekday when my kids are at school. So, like 8 to 3 is my standard writing time every weekday. I'm not always writing in that time, but I'm doing something writing related, like I'm doing this interview with you guys right now.
Right, right.
Or, right, answering interview questions. I've been doing a lot of that this week. Or, revising or reading a research book or something. But right now I'm drafting my next book, and I have a deadline for when I need to have it finished. So my pretty standard writing process is just to write 5 pages every weekday when I'm drafting a book. And I actually haven't gotten them done yet today because I've had a few interviews, so I need to try to get them done this afternoon before my kids get home. But that's sort of my pretty standard goal for myself. Just do 5 pages a day when I'm drafting. And sometimes I do work, like if I have a deadline, sometimes I will work on the weekend, or I'll work at night if I need to. But pretty typically it's just every weekday.
And when you're researching and writing, when you have a book that requires a lot of research, do you tend to do like all the research up front and then write, or do you write and come to a point where you need to find something out and go look it up?
Yeah, I don't do all the research up front. I usually do a little bit of research, and then I write, and then there'll be gaps in that first draft, and then I'll go back and do a second round of research and kind of fill in some of those gaps, or revise a little bit. And then also I'll research as I'm going along. Like sometimes, I'll need to look up a specific thing for a specific chapter, and so I'll do that, that morning when I'm writing it. But I feel like if I wait too long to start writing, I lose track of the story. And even though it's historical and there are real things in it, I always want the characters and the story to sort of be the most important. So I need to know enough to get that base first draft. But then I feel like if I know too much, it's hard to be creative around that, if that makes any sense.
And it's one of the real advantages of the internet is that if you need to look something up, it's not a huge interruption. You don't have to drop everything, run to the library,
Yeah.
look in the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature,
But
try
I
and figure
did
out.
spend the entire day trying to figure out what brand of lipstick my character would be carrying in her purse. And so I've
Seriously?
learned that, like, sometimes details like that, I can just put a note in the first draft, fill in later, so I don't.
Yeah, you can really go down the rabbit hole on stuff like that,
You
can't you?
definitely can go down the rabbit hole, yeah.
And when you're doing that, do you come up with other ideas for other stories?
Sometimes I do. I have a secret Pinterest board of like story ideas, and so I'm constantly finding little things and just pinning it on there for later.
Oh, perfect.
Oh gosh.
Perfect. Wow.
I was going to ask you if reading about these things that happened, these terrible things that happen to people, does that sometimes get depressing for you?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely does. It's depressing, but then it's also hopeful that I can fictionalize stories and that I can end them the way that I want to sometimes.
Right.
But
Because
yeah.
there had to be some happy endings in all these, some of these
Yeah.
real life
It
stories.
does. It does. I mean, it does get depressing to think about some of the awful details and that, the day-to-day stuff. But then I'm also glad that I know them too. I feel like everybody should know them.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that's what I love about historical fiction. We find out things that we never even dreamed of, Because, yeah, I grew up during the Second World War, and of course, we heard, well, in every time you went to the movies, there was a newsreel, and it was filled with things about the war, and that's how we, because there was not television then or anything, and so we had a pretty good idea of what was going on, I think, but I don't think we realized that the complete horror of until after the liberation of the camp and everything.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone could actually believe that stuff was happening. Like you said, even the Germans, Jews who were living there, couldn't believe that it was going to get that bad.
Yeah, I think it was hard to imagine, impossible to imagine.
I know, and sometimes things we're living through now, you wonder, is this just the first sign of things getting that bad? Could it happen again?
Yeah.
Well, we have to really work harder to make sure that doesn't happen somehow.
Yeah. It's just you don't know where the line is. Where is the line where you say, okay, this is too far and we have to do whatever it takes to stop it?
And I mean, writing this book, I thought a lot about too, you know, what would you become numb to? Just living there and experiencing things day after day and week after week. And how would that look different to you than how it looks to us now, all these years later, you know?
Yeah. And like Max and his friends didn't think Hitler would gain power. They didn't think he.
Right.
You know, and how it actually happened is almost unbelievable too.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a few weeks since I read the story, and I've read quite a few World War II stories lately, but yours was the one that talked about the elections, right? So give us a little history lesson on that.
Oh my gosh. So it's been a little while since I've written it, so I might get it wrong. Okay. But, you know, there were a few different elections. And, you know, at first the Nazi Party didn't win that much of the vote. And then they sort of got more and more. And oh my goodness, I can't remember his name, but somebody else was the president. And then he died and Hitler sort of stepped in and appointed himself Chancellor and Führer and, you know, everything for the country and started taking away powers and just people went on about their lives, basically.
Yeah. And
the fact that after the First World War, the Germans had to pay reparations to the rest of Europe, and that's what made them so bitter about it.
Right, and there was an economic depression too. You know, that people were struggling in Germany at the time, and so I think they were also like looking for hope. You know, they wanted things to be better.
And of course, they had to have a scapegoat for things, and that's
right, exactly.
That's the thing that's so scary.
Yes, it is.
And that's where you see the parallels today, I think.
Yes, true.
Jillian, on a lighter note, do you know the entire story from the beginning? Do you know the basic plot points and how it's going to end, or are you more of a seat of the pantser?
I'm more of a seat of the pantser, but I usually know something. You know, I sort of have this like hazy idea of where my characters end up, but I don't 100% know how they're going to get there. And so I feel like if I know everything, I get a little bored when I'm writing. And part of the fun in writing is writing to discover what's going to happen and how they're going to get there. But I do have to have some direction. You know, it's not just aimless.
Was there anything in particular in this book that surprised you?
I think it was the chapters that took place after the war, and just I don't know why, but I had never really thought before about how long it would take the other cities in Europe to recover. You know, it was like the war was over and people didn't just move on. These cities had been destroyed and London was bombed. So it was sort of thinking about that and thinking about how Hannah would see it. Hannah, who couldn't remember the war, was continually shocked when she would walk around the city and there would be piles of rubble. And at one point, she's going to see this doctor, Henry, who's trying to help her recover her memory. And he tells her how terrifying it was, how they all thought that they were going to die. And I think realizing that surprised me. You know, I should have known that, but I just never had thought about it before.
Mm-hmm.
Did the characters?
We really have no idea, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Did the characters do anything that surprised you?
Yes. So there's one chapter in the middle of the book that's narrated by Elsa, who is Max's, you know, Max's school friend. Johan marries this woman, Elsa, and so he becomes Max, and she becomes Max and Hannah's friend too. And it surprised me that she needed a chapter.
Ah.
And I've actually written that chapter from Max's point of view, and it was just bugging me and bugging me. And like 2 weeks later, I went back and I was like, this has to be Elsa's chapter. And Elsa tells you some things in that chapter that are surprising. So it surprised me when I was writing that I put that in there. And then actually, when I was editing the book, my editor asked me if I wanted to take it out because it was the only chapter not from Max and Hannah. And I said no. Like, I really thought, I was like, no, Elsa needs to tell this chapter. I tried it another way and it didn't work. So wow. It was kind of surprising.
That's really cool. I like that. I like that. Does that make it more fun as a writer when something like that happens?
I mean, fun and frustrating because I think I had hit the 70,000 word mark, and then I had to go back and delete like 5,000 words. And so I felt like I took a giant step backwards in order to add Elsa in and correct what I felt wrong. So it was like frustrating at the time, but now in hindsight, it sounds really fun.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah. You have definite number of words that for each of your books that you're trying to hit a.
No, I mean, different stories are different lengths, but I mean, a novel, I think this book is around 90,000 words and my last book was around 85,000. And so it's somewhere in that range usually for me to tell the story, but I've had shorter ones and longer ones too.
Well, from my standpoint, it was just right.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Well, that is about all we have time for today. So it's been really fun talking to you about In Another Time.
Yeah, thank you. It's been fun talking with you, too.
And it's a great read. It was, like Mom said, it's a page-turner. It's one that I sat down and didn't want to get up till I'd finished.
I know.
Thank you.
Yeah. A really, really good story. And, Mom, do you have some final words for us today?
Well, I do. Even now, in a world of difficulties and sadness for many people worldwide, here's to kind women and gentle men. May we know them. May we raise them. May we be them.
Thank you.
And I love that.
And Jillian, do you have any final words of advice for aspiring writers?
You know, the best advice that I think I ever got was from a professor in grad school, and all he said was butt in chair. And to me, that just means you can always find a reason not to write, or you can find something else to do, but you just have to sit down and you have to do the work every day and just keep going.
And congratulations on doing that successfully for all these books.
Thank you. Thank you.
And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye.
Bye.